Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to tonight's edition of Magical Musings. You are tuned in to a pagan podcast done by Joy and Brian. For the next 2 hours, we're going to be talking tonight, and hopefully y'all will enjoy the topic. Tonight's topic is going to be on pagan sexuality and pagan mysticism regarding that sexuality and possibly where they came from. We're also going to be archiving this on our website, and this is going to be our sixth show.
It's really? Oh. Awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Great?
Thanks for joining us tonight. If you folks have an account on Blog Talk Radio, you can also join us live in the chat room, where you can ask questions or just chit-chat with us or other listeners. We always love having direct feedback from listeners through that chat room. So, you know, if you happen to be on there and want to tell us something, ask us something, or share your own experience, we would be glad to hear from you. You can also call into the show if you want to make a comment or ask questions at 646-564.
Or just yell at us because we're idiots, you know.
Exactly. 646-564-9966. That's based out of New York City. We are working on getting a 1-800 number for you guys to encourage more interaction. But yeah, let's
1-800 numbers cost money, so we're going to now segue into part of the ads. We are totally self-sufficient right now. But as website space and accounts to bring you the podcast and 800 numbers do cost a little bit of funds, you know, we've got some ads on our website, and if you want to throw $5, $10 our way through the donate button, we would highly encourage you to do so, simply because, you know, this is out of our pocket, too.
Exactly.
Plus, it's a good show that, you know, you appreciate what we're doing and what we're talking about. So I guess with that said, we could go ahead and get into the show. What do you think?
I think we can probably do that today.
Well, like I said earlier, my name's Joe, and Brian is the guy that keeps popping in occasionally. We are on Blog Talk Radio, and tonight's topic is sexuality and paganism. Now, what we're going to be discussing isn't going to be sex magic, although we probably will touch on that a little bit. Sex magic is actually more about dealing with magic with a sexual component where that generates the energy. So we'll mention it, but we're going to move on. Because when we talk about sexuality and paganism, we're actually talking about the fact that most of the pagan belief systems are structured around a male-female dichotomy and a fertility dichotomy. If you look at Wicca for any length of time, what you're going to see is you're going to see that it is a fertility religion. It is about ensuring the crops growing and the babies being born safely and the ladies not dying in childbirth and things like that. And you're going to see a repetition of a male-female dichotomy. Well, this leaves a really big glaring question when you start adding in modern society. What happens to all the gay people? And that's some of what we're going to talk about tonight. And we're going to start all of this by talking about the general perception in normal society of the promiscuity of pagans and Wiccans in specific. Okay, I know that one of the bad raps that we tend to get is that pagans in general are seen as being more sexually promiscuous than other religious groups. It's not that they actually are more promiscuous. It's just that this perception is, and it comes from a lot of different areas. One of the areas that it comes from, I believe, is it's a leftover from the free love of the 1970s. Because when you talk about it coming into American society, paganism and Wicca started out 65 or so in America and then started growing. Well, at the same time, you got the Vietnam War going on. You've got the tune-in dropout culture with drugs. And you've got all of the free love advocates and the hippies, okay? All of that sort of got folded into each other and classed as either hippieism or paganism or whatever. And I think part of it came from, Mary, I love you desperately. The pill and people getting anal retentive. Yes, okay. You got to understand, my wife is here. We're going to be talking, and she's going to be kibitzing, and she's the official researcher. But I can't talk and watch her sign at me at the same time. My brain just doesn't work like that. Anyhow, the pill also came out during that same time period. So sex became more freely available, and unfortunately, paganism movement of the time, which you can get a snapshot of it from Drawing Down the Moon, got a real rap of being sexually promiscuous. Okay, not so much now, although it does still happen. Some of the other reasons, I think, it's also a reaction to the Victorian morals. At the time when the 70s were going on, you had very rigid, very structuralized, very anal retentive, I guess you would call it, society with, men are men and women are in the kitchen and, this is the way things are. And if you have a short haircut, then you're conservative. But if you have any length to your hair at all, then, you're a liberal hippie dude who, needs to be put down. And so you've got that societal conflict going on. But that societal conflict came out of the sexual morals of the Victorian times. It's a logical conclusion to it. Where they're very conservative sexually. You don't talk about it. You lay in bed. The woman lays in bed on her back with her legs spread, and the guy is on top of her. And if she gets off, that's great. But, if she orgasms inside of her, that's what's important. And it's her duty to do this, and she must do it. And it's only for children and things along those lines.
Though I do wonder Sorry, I mean, I kind of wonder at the whole repressive culture that was developed in the Victorian era, because Queen Victoria herself was apparently quite free with her loving. Multiple lovers, very, young and easygoing, and it wasn't until she got older that, the image of the conservative, stoic, frigid old woman came along.
Well, there's a wonderful movie that talks about this. It's called Mrs. Brown. Understand that when her husband was alive, yes, she was very sexually active, but she didn't talk about it. They did kiss in public. They would hold hands. They would go out and do things, and then he died. Well, I guess the attitude at the time was, if you're a widow, that's it. You're not supposed to have any sexual activity later. And then along comes one of the servants that she just absolutely falls in love with. and he's there for her and taking care of her and talking to her. And even though he's, you know, much lower on the social ladder than she is, she was having a sexual relationship with him. It wasn't talked about. It was kind of acknowledged as a backhanded whisper. And that's where some of the sexual repression came out of. And I think, I mean, I'm not a sexual expert. You'd have to talk to Lacey Green probably and figure out how the actual history of the sexuality came down. But the time period when the paganism was coming into America, it was a rebellion against this also, this let's not talk about it. I mean, when Mary was given her big sex talk by her mother stalked into her room in, what, 1964 or something, and looked at her and shook her finger and said, don't do it. And Mary was like, do what? And her mother was like, never mind what, just don't do it, and then stalked out. You know, so it was like, oh, okay, I have no idea what's going on. Two books on menstruation and what happened is what she was given, because her mom was a nurse and was actually a free thinker at the time. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, would get given to kids at the time. So having somebody say, look, I have somebody that I love, and you love them too, and this is great, and let's both hug each other, all three of us, and I love you, and you love me, and you love my love, and I love my love, and she loves you, and you, and you, and that makes us all brothers, you know. And the love got confused with sex. And you can love multiple people, just doesn't mean that you're having sex with them, you know. But then open-minded and talking about, okay, look, this is your vagina. This is where you pee from. Look at your own vagina. Here's a mirror. You know, and this was a revolutionary thing when it started. You know, you've got Masters and Johnson also that were coming out with a clinical study of sex and men and women and how they do stuff. You know, and so this was revolutionary at the same time. And all of this got folded into the counterculture, and then all of that got rolled over onto paganism. Okay? So I think all of this just started getting together and started really snowballing, and a lot of, I don't know, attitudes and things that probably shouldn't have gotten put together with paganism kind of got forced into there. Beatniks and hippies and free love and drugs and those weirdos down the street and them witches and Satanists, and they're going to go out and kill all the kids, and, you know, all of that got put together from the conservative perspective. Unfortunately, along with that, you've got the gays and lesbians that got shoved in there too. Plus, when you actually look at some of the tenets of Wicca, you got the Charge of the Goddess, you know, and it says in the Charge of the Goddess that as a symbol of this, you shall be naked in your rites, and you shall be free of artifice. Okay, well, then you've got, you know, nudity in it, and then you've got things like the woodblock of Satan with naked witches dancing around them, you know, that got started published in things like Drawing Down the Moon and other books like this, you know, just showing, okay, this is what witchcraft looks like. And yes, there's a naked woman there, but you know what? There's lots of naked women back during that time and those time periods when they're making that art. And people are like, oh, it's Satan. And oh, it's a naked woman. Oh, we can't, oh, there's, oh, they could process it. So it kind of got a bad rap at that point. And I understand it, I understand where it came from. And then there's, you know, the whole feminism thing and the Dianic witchcraft and that outgrowth. Because then they're saying, not only are you free to be a sexual being, women, who are part of Wicca and part of paganism, but men are the cause of all of your problems, you know, and you've got the patriarchy and the rape culture, and, you know, men are bad things, and they've screwed up our society. So, you know, you got the reactionaries there, too. So anyway, all of that got, like I said, shoved onto paganism and shoved into Wicca, and it's still there, and it's still, we're still trying to get things pulled out. Then you add in the fact that Wicca has a rite called the Great Rite, where literally, supposedly, the priest, the reigning priest, is supposed to have sex with the reigning priestess in the ritual. Okay, you've got a few books. One of them is Heather Confessions of a Witch, which state that this was literally done during the rituals, and that this was a common thing. All right, I don't personally believe that, but then I've also never been initiated into some of the Oathbound orders where it might have been done. I don't think so, though, because from a reasonable perspective, if you were a priest or priestess in a coven situation, these are the 13 closest people to you. You're around them. You may know them. You've gone to school with them. You've talked with them. You've ritualed with them over and over and over. Would you really be comfortable having sex with somebody in a circle with them? Probably not. Because that's a very private thing. There are certain people that could overcome that. It would take a whole lot, I think, to be able to overcome that and actually do the literal Great Rite. But it's a ritual that has been published and that is out there. Okay, what they came up with to enact in a coven situation is what's called the symbolic Great Rite, wherein the priestess takes a bowl or a chalice and holds it up to her chest underneath her breasts. And the priest takes an asame and places it into the bowl or into the chalice. This symbolizes, the asame, of course, symbolizes the penis. The chalice symbolizes the womb. And the placing the asame into the vagina, he is symbolically taking the priestess with that asame. And done properly in a ritual setting, it's an extremely powerful ritual. There have been some that I've seen where those roles were reversed, and the male held the chalice, and the female put the asame into it. I saw in the Real Witches Ball in Columbus, Ohio, one year where I went to it in 2001, a grand ritual where it was to gay priests, and one acted in the role of the priestess, and the priest and his partner used a sword and, you know, did the Great Rite right there, and it was extremely beautiful. You know, because this is not something that you're supposed to be scared of. This is for the fertility of the crops and the herds and the people. And there's really no energy that's as great and as abundant as sexual energy. I mean, think about how your brain shuts down when you orgasm. Okay, and I don't care if you're masturbating to orgasm or actually having physical sex to orgasm or just, you know, licking your partner out to a point where they come. It generates lots and lots and lots of energy that normally would go into creating a new life, okay? If you are an accomplished enough magician, you can grab all of that energy before it goes into the life and put it into the fertility of the land or put it into a spell. And that buildup and that release makes it even more potent.
Well, okay? And the whole concept, too, I mean, the idea of harnessing that energy isn't just a pagan thing. I mean, you have it talked about in Gnosticism. You have it talked about in Tantra. The idea that you can harness that and use the energy in other ways than simply sexual release or the creation of life is even in spiritual alchemy. The whole point is basically that you turn this energy into something powerful. You direct it to other purposes, whether that be the casting of the spell or the transmutation and development of the soul, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, there's literally all kinds of things. Any energetic release that you get from the elements, from raising energy by dancing and singing and chanting, or meditation or whatever, you can use sexual energy for, okay? It is another energy source, and it's an extremely appropriate to use this energy for creation magics, you know, because this is energy that is invoked through the act of sex, which is for creation. Therefore, taking that energy and using it to create a new situation in your life, it makes it just that much better, you know. So you have that ritual in there also, and you get a lot of people going, oh, well, all those weirdos that do dancing at night out in the moon, they're you know, just sexual fiends. That's where we got the rap from, you know. Now, it doesn't mean that that's actually what's going on. It means that from a practitioner's standpoint, that a lot of the people who are in paganism have managed to recognize that the sexual mores of the society are limiting. They are cutting us off from not only a source of potent energy, but from a very potent way of drawing together, a bonding type thing. I think in Stranger in a Strange Land, they called it a growing closer, because that's what it is. I mean, it's you know, a means of two people becoming one for a little while. But it's also a means of worship. Because, I mean, if we look at it, you've got a male deity and a female deity. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the is and the god and the goddess and yin and yang and those concepts. Well, here you go. You've got a deity that's male and a deity that's female. And it would be ludicrous in the extreme to think that they don't have sex. I mean, you know, that spring and fall, I would think one of the things that they would be doing the most in the spring is, you know, returning life to everything around us as all of nature is waking up. The birds are singing, the eggs are hatching, people are, you know, coming out of the slumber of the winter. And the best way to do that is to, you know, hey, have sex, you know. So I have completely lost my train of thought here. Mary's saying one of the best ways to disparage a new faith is to accuse them of deviance in sexual practice and to accuse them of being immoral. That's what I was saying. Looking at it from a practitioner's standpoint, being able to identify that that is holding us back and move beyond it is one of the big keys to knowing yourself and understanding that you're growing beyond what you were taught when you were little. I don't know about you guys that are listening, but when I was young, I was taught that sex was bad and that I shouldn't do it until I was married. And then, you know, we only had babies from it and didn't talk about it other than that. And masturbation was killing billions and billions of people before, you know, every time you jacked off, because you should not spill your seed on the ground. And that gets really limiting mentally and spiritually. It holds you back, and it starts causing this guilt cancer to grow internally. Well, once you identify that, you kind of need to eradicate it in order to move beyond it. So you find that the sexual morals are a big source of one of those things that you need to change when you get involved in paganism. I'm trying to think here, and it's just not working.
Do you have your little outline handy?
Oh, yeah, I've got the outline handy. It's just that this is there's times when my brain just locks up for no reason when I'm thinking. Oh, Mary's got a good point here. The Victorian morals are not morals from Queen Victoria. They're morals from the men of Victoria's time in trying to control women and women's sexual desires. And one of the things that I thought was neat when I found out about it was that there used to be a medical procedure to where women would go into a doctor and he would take a vibrator and use that to have them orgasm. And this was, you know, cleansing for the women. But it wasn't done very often. This was a medical procedure. And I was like, you are freaking kidding.
That is interesting medicine.
It is. It was frequency as frequently as the women could afford it. Because, and here's another one. It was thought that the uterus migrated around the body and that was the cause of hysteria in women, which is why when you go in and have the surgery to remove your uterus, it's called a hysterectomy because it is removing the hysteria from the women's body.
Well, I mean, the Greek word for womb is hyster, so it does make complete sense.
It would at that. Now we're going to move into one of the big sections of the night, and this is talking about gender issues and homosexuality in Wicca. One of the huge debates and that still goes on amongst at least I think new people is why in the heck would somebody who is not gender binary, meaning male, female, heterosexual, cissexual, be attracted to Wicca? And the answer is because they're people. It's a very simple question. Yes, there are male. There's a male deity and a female deity. Yes, the male deity has sex with the female deity. Yes, the female deity gives birth. Yes, the male deity helps raise whatever. The female deity sometimes gives birth to the god who in turn grows up and then has sex with her to die off to give birth to the next god who grows up. I'm not kidding. This is where they got the Father Time thing, where he's a baby in the new year and then grows up throughout the year and is very old at the end of the year and then dies. Well, where does the new baby new year come from? Well, from the mother goddess. And it's because he had sex with her to impregnate her so that she could give birth to him, reincarnated. It's the cycle of the seasons. So, you know, When you start thinking about somebody that would be sexually attracted to people of the same sex, the question kind of becomes, well, why would they be part of it? And the answer is, why not? I mean, pagans are just as messed up about homosexuals as the general populace is. There's no difference in that because paganism is made up of people just like everything else. And unfortunately, there's also been authors who have written about this debate, even though it shouldn't be a debate, and it's kind of become codified as part of the pagan, the body of pagan lore, if you want to look at it that way.
To be fair, though, I think that a lot of that comes from the older authors that, you know, existed in the early time of, like, the sexual revolution and through the 50s and that sort of thing. I mean, Dion Fortune is pretty conservative as far as gender is concerned as well. And, you know, she's like one of those classic authors for esoteric topics. And you get the same with Blavatsky and Alice Bailey as well.
You know, who's
her as well. I don't
really
remember reading anything from her, but.
Well,
and I mean,
she's not talking. She wasn't talking about the question of whether gay and lesbian should be in paganism. She was more the extreme second wave feminism where all things male are bad, and she's very much a homophobe. You know, because if you're male, you know, if you have a penis and testicles, even vestigial ones, you're the cause of everything that's evil in the world. And it's your fault, and you need to, you know, be put in camps and bred like dogs. And that's it. You know, and she's proven over and over and over that she still feels that way, even at 75. Because she's a transphobe as well. She has an open thing about calling in all women of all shapes and sizes to come to this ritual that she has. And then, you know, trans women who used to be male, who are going through quite a number of hoops to become female, come to the ritual, and she's, no, you're still men. You have something between your legs. You don't have a uterus anymore. You don't have a uterus. You're not a real woman. At which point all the ladies who had hysterectomies go, excuse me? And, well, you had a uterus, so you're a real woman, but they never had a uterus, so they can't have babies. And all of the people that are sterile go, excuse me? You know, so she's stuck her foot in it multiple, multiple times. And it's one of those... We'll talk about that in a little bit. She is really bad about it. So. No, actually who I was thinking about was a statement in Buckland's Big Blue Book where he says, you know, while it's highly unlikely that somebody who is gay or lesbian would be attracted to Wicca, if they come to your circle, welcome them. Okay. And certain other authors decided to take umbrage at that and called him out on it, at which point Buckland re-explained it, and they called him out on it again, and it became kind of a big mess. But the question is still there. You know, why would they be attracted? And personally, I don't see why wouldn't they. I've known probably about six covens and six very powerful high priestesses in their area. And of that group, half of them had homosexuals in the clergy as the working priests or priestesses. And of the rest, they had homosexual members. You know, so it's not about the genitals. It's not about the ability to have babies. It's about the... It's about the who you love and the compatibility, okay? And that's where we get the one of the big debates, okay? Most of the clergy, at least that I know of, that have been at this for more than 10 years, are like, what the hell does it matter? Having lesbian, gay, bi, trans, asexual, intersex, and genderqueer members and clergy is not a big deal because, once again, it's not about the genitals. It's about compatibility, and it's about the love that you have for your fellow human beings. One of the things that I try to tell others is it's not the wrapping, it's the present inside. And that works for human beings. Yes, the pretty wrapping paper and the pretty packaging are important as far as initially attracting your interest and initially getting somebody to notice you. But after that, the wrapping paper fades. You don't appreciate a present for how prettily it's packaged. What you appreciate is the gift inside. That's where the value is at. So as far as LGBT, AIQ people are concerned, you know, they're going to be there. You might as well just go, okay, you know, they're here. Now, on a practical matter, when you're talking about, let's say you have a lesbian priestess who is working with a straight heterosexual male priest, okay? Are they going to be doing the actual great rite where he's having sex with her and she's just, you know, whatever, I'd rather you were a girl? Probably not. Can they do the symbolic great rite? Sure, why not? As I said, you know, I've known a very gay male priest in a coven down in Grand Prairie, Texas, in fact. One of the ladies that wound up teaching me a whole lot. And he, you know, and he and she were very good together. They had a really good practice and a very powerful combination, even though he wasn't attracted to her at all. And it's not that attraction. It's still the energy that you're bringing up. Okay? You know, and this is one of those topics that's very, very close to home for me. I don't know how many of you have actually been listening closely to some of the other podcasts that we've done, but I've outed myself a couple of times, and I'm going to do it again here. I'm a trans woman. I started out life as a male. I've had a child that I contributed my half of the genetic code to. And all my life I've been fighting these females of these feelings of being female. And finally, about 3 years ago, I said, screw it, I'm tired of fighting, and have taken lots of steps to become female. I'm living 24/7 as a female. I've taken a female name. I have Joy, obviously. I have rededicated myself to the Lord and Lady, changing my magical working name from Davin to Aaron, which is why when you go to the website, you'll see Aaron's journal and Davin all over the place. That's why. And there have been a few people that have gone, what the hell? What, huh? And the point that I've come to is that, look, if the gods accept me as I am and understand the change and I'm considered as much of a daughter of Rhiannon as I ever was a priest of Hearn, then why the hell do you have a problem with it? Because this is about my spirituality and my spiritual expression and my association with the gods, not yours.
This is very true.
You know. So you do have, you know, trans clergy out there. And no, they may not have a vagina to be able to stick a penis into. But why does that matter? I mean, truthfully, the only time it becomes an issue is if you're actually having sex. And in a situation where you're doing rituals, it is highly, highly unlikely that you will actually be having sex in public at a ritual. So it's not going to matter. if you are having sex as part of a ritual, let's say at Beltane, when the fertility of the earth is being renewed, and it is important to actually have sex, you're probably going to be doing it with your partner of record or somebody that you're comfortable with in private, in your bedroom. And that's when it's important. That's the only time when the configuration of Audi and Innie has any bearing on any paganism ritual. Okay? What?
What?
Oh, there's something. Oh, I thought I heard you chuckling or something.
No, I coughed. No,
okay.
I was thinking a chuckle when you said Audi versus Innie, and I was like, okay. Never thought of them that way, but sure.
Well, I mean, with the reconstructive surgeries that they've got, you know, that's essentially all that you can call it. Because what they're doing is they're taking what's there and they're changing it around in the configuration, and you can't really call the penis that they construct from a female's vagina and mons and the labia and everything like that a penis. It looks like a penis. It's a phalloplasty. That's the name of the procedure. But you can't really call it a penis because while you can urinate out of it, you can't. It doesn't really get hard. And it's not going to ejaculate sperm, and there's no prostate gland to make the semen. So you can't – yeah, the semen is the juice. Yes. Okay, she's arguing with me. Yes, Mary is the researcher, so research it, researcher. anyway. so you can't really call that a penis. You can call it a phallic item. Easier just to call it an Audi, in my opinion. And that's,
fair enough.
You know, that's one thing, to pay attention to. People have been dealing with gays, lesbians, bisexuals. Trans people in paganism for centuries. I mean, you want a good example of this? There's the two-spirit people in Native tribes, okay? There have always been people who felt like they were part of the other gender, and they wanted to live with that gender expression. Okay, sometimes they're gay and attracted to members of the opposite gender. Sometimes they are not. And, okay, this is where the terminology gets really, really messed up because Mary just pointed something out. You can't be gay and attracted to members of the opposite gender. When I say gay in this connotation, okay, it's the birth gender versus the gender of expression. Okay, so your birth gender is male. You wish to be female, okay, but you're attracted to men. That, unfortunately, is considered to be homosexual, okay, because you were born as a male, you're attracted to males, all right? Like me, being born male and going to female, having that female expression, but still being attracted to women, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, is considered to be heterosexual. It's not. I consider it to be lesbian. But, you know, this is where the terminology gets really fuzzy because we're starting to deal with a lot of this terminology, and unfortunately, it hasn't been well dealt with by our society for years and years and years and years. Getting back to the two-spirit people, you would have somebody that felt that they were female, would put on a dress, would do the female work, take care of the teepee and take care of the food supplies and pack and everything like that. and make a camp while the person that they're attracted to would go out and hunt and kill and grab horses from other tribes and drag them back. They would, in a lot of cases, be considered to be closer to the spirits than somebody who was cissexual, which means their gender expression matches their biological gender, and heterosexual, okay? Because they could express not only the male side, their biological gender, but they could also express the female qualities and the female side of the equation. And I think that's something that really needs to be looked at hard by a lot of pagan organizations, is they may not be better at being medicine people. They may not be more holy. They may not be closer to the spirits, but they do have yin and yang as one person, and therefore they can okay, fine. Mary's telling me that she's right about the semen and sperm and everything. The testes make sperm. The seminal vesicle makes the amino acids. The prostate makes, prostate to specific antigen. Okay, apparently the prostate doesn't make all of the fluids, but semen is made by something else. Your testicles. Okay, fine. I love her so much, but she has this absolute pathological need to be right. All right, she has a did y'all hear her? Can you hear her?
I barely heard her in the background.
Okay, she said she has a
pathological need for the truth to be correctly produced and presented.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
This is what I live with. This is what I'm married to for 22 years now. So I don't know. I guess okay. We were talking about two spirit people. That combination of both in one. There was a druid group that I was in touch with a long time ago down in Texas. Who seemed to be okay, but they seemed to have their own ideas about Druidism and what that was. One of the things that they had an idea about, which I thought, you know, was fairly unique when I encountered it, was that there was one of the things that you had to go through to prove that you were a druid, and thus a priest of the gods, their gods, was that you also had to manifest in a ritual the goddess through you to prove that you could be both to each person. It was fairly unique. I've never encountered this anyplace else, but it is something that would probably be a really good measure of a priest or priestess's control of not of self, but of the energies and the ritual. And it's probably something that should also be discussed some more as well amongst other groups as to whether that should be started to be included. Because I'll tell you something, some of the ideas that are out there in paganism in general these days were revolutionary 60 years ago. They're kind of starting to get outdated, and I think society's starting to pass them by. Two guys walking down the street holding hands is not radical anymore. Two women kissing is almost blasé. which is how it should be, and that's something that should be looked at. So, you know, having a special place for a gay or bi clergy, you know, it's like, okay, and it shouldn't, and it should be about that shocking. Let's see. Brian, I've been doing all the talking. You've been kind of quiet. Do you want to talk about any of this stuff? Any of your thoughts?
Well, I don't know that I really have much to contribute as far as gender is concerned, because I'm a cis male, and I happen to be bisexual, but it's not something that is, you know, special and, you know, defining within my life. It's just there. I mean, this is the case with me, right? Alrighty. Now, I suppose that speaking in terms of the history, you know, the history of modern paganism, there is kind of a level of, you know, ooh and ah kind of attention gathering that, you know, might have been existent back in the day. But over the course of time, I think it's just become so common, like Joyce said, that, you know, there isn't really a need to make a big deal about anything like that. And I mean, I know that there are certain groups in which gender and sexual orientation, all this kind of thing, are a very big issue and, you know, are a major thing that you kind of have to focus on and draw attention to. But I personally don't believe that it generally matters. Most, especially solitary, but most magical and spiritual practices that deal with the idea of gender or, you know, I guess I'll call it channeling, are the sort of thing where it's kind of an effort that you make to create balance within yourself. So it ultimately doesn't matter which gender you are, because the idea is to create the state of harmony within yourself that unites both the anima and animus in yourself. So bringing that into a group ritual, whether you're playing a role of goddess or, you know, that sort of thing, versus playing the god in a ritual, with your proper development, it really isn't a big issue. Welcome back, Joy.
Thank you. Sorry, guys, I had to step off for a second. Nature called, so
it's
not something
that
you really. It will at the wrong times. Anyway, go ahead. Finish up your thought.
I've done, you know, there's not much more I can go into without discussing it at length, you know, dealing with Gnosticism and whatnot. So I'm going to just withhold that.
Well, if it's relevant, I mean, God, that's what, you know, we've gone through 90% of the notes I made here. And it's only halfway through the show. So if it's relevant,
well, I mean, I don't know that it really is specifically, because in most spiritual practices, the idea of coming to grips with, you know, the balance of that, quote, dichotomy within yourself is sort of the ultimate purpose of the work. I mean, you know, it creates a state of balanced.
Right, but when you get right down to it, I mean, the soul doesn't have a gender. If you listen to the New Age mysticism, and, you know, some of the older myths also, you have a soul that encompasses everything. It is a asexual, floaty thing that can pass through walls, that doesn't have male or female. The sexual component and the gender component comes from the body it comes into that it creates to live a life on the physical realm, and the inputs put in from the senses and stuff. But once you strip those away, you still have this, you know, asexual entity that has a consciousness. And if you go through, you know, there's several schools of reincarnation that say you have to embody as both sexes at some point. And my own work with that, yeah, there's been people who have embodied as male and female. Some hypnotherapists, you know, say that that's because we're not actually tapping into the lifetimes that particular soul had, but tapping into the overall consciousness of everything, which has, you know, male and female parts to it. But then there's, you know, the ones that their last lifetime was as the opposite gender. There's going to be the workings that Mary and I have done show that we're going to be a lesbian couple next lifetime, you know, and I'm going to finally be a little bitty short girl, and she's going to be a mid-sized girl who gets to dominate me, which is going to be great. But that's, you know, that's a possibility. But, you know, there's some that say, well, you know, you're not doing that now, you know, and it's like, well, no, we're not, but it's still my soul. So, you know, having those, having both of those combined into one is what is the point. And you have to experience both in order to get a balanced viewpoint.
Well, and I think that that's kind of where the, I mean, you're blending in notions of reincarnation and kind of past life memories that, you know, are experiences of one gender or the other. And I know that's a very popular idea. At the same time, there's a lot of New Agers who will speak in terms of being a certain gender as their soul. Like, they'll, you know, their soul is insert gender here, and regardless of the body it manifests into, it is the same gender. You know, right. There's a lot of people who are completely of the opinion that, you know, the soul is an androgynous entity. And I do kind of think that that makes a lot more sense, especially when you consider the notion that the one consciousness, the, you know, you might call it the I am or the oversoul or the is or the, you know, whatever the fuck you want to call it. This collective sea of knowledge and
souls,
you know, experience and yeah, souls. I mean, I think it's a very sort of weird idea to sort of assign a gender to that when it's made up of the memories and experiences of every single human being that has ever existed being recycled and drawn from. Because I'm of the opinion that if that soul consciousness, whatever, exists, that if there are this many souls that collectively unite with it after death, then manifesting one specific gendered soul out of that would be like pulling a grain of salt out of, you know, a salt shaker. They're all technically salt, so why would you specify that it had to have a specific gender? Because it's the same regardless. No, I guess salt would be a bad metaphor. Let's call it a drop in the ocean. You know, it's all water, right? You're not pulling out, like, the salt from the sea. You're pulling out water from the ocean.
Well, if you want to also go by, you know, the averages, of the world population, 51% is female. So, you know, if you're going to give something that is that conglomeration a sex, then you would have to go by, you know, the average, which is, you know, female. And, you know, but trying to, you know, as we talked about with deities and deity concepts, that's, you know, the is so unimaginable that we can't even start relating to it. So, you know, trying to sex it is, like you said, about as frustrating as pulling one molecule of salt out of the ocean, you know, one specific molecule, you know.
Exactly.
Personally, I just think, you know, the best we're going to be ever do is we deal with the deities we've got, the sexes that they are, the personalities they have, and ignore all the rest. Because while you've got all of the other deities up there, and while they all have, you know, elements, you know, Mars can be gentle and caring, and the most motherly Kuan Yin can be mean and abusive, you know, because there's elements to every single person that are also found in other people. It's just what is emphasized and what is looked at and what they act upon. So you have to kind of acknowledge that and go, okay, well, I'm dealing with this deity who has this temper, and I'm just going to deal with that because that's complex enough that I'm not going to try to deal with their mothering kind side, and they're an absolute son of a bitch.
Well, I'm thinking right now that maybe what we should do then is to play one song that will play about 5 minutes, a Sharon Knight song called I Fall to My Knees, and then we'll go into perhaps a discussion on the sex lives of the gods themselves. Because if you go into multiple different pantheons, I mean, you're going into some crazy-ass sex lives.
Yeah.
So let's do that. Exactly. So, yeah, we'll see you guys in 5 minutes. Enjoy this song, Sharon Knight's I Fall to My Knees.
I wander alone, seeking out mystery, wondering where the wild things roam. I have heard tale of poets gone mad with the wine of the muse on the top. Break bread on the shore, filling my cup, devotion filled from my heart. The natural beauty surrounding my senses, dangling through me as far.
Yeah.
folks. Hope you enjoyed that. That was Sharon Knight with I Fall to My Knees. Now, one of the things that we wanted to talk about tonight were the ideas that, depending on the pantheon of gods that you're dealing with, there are examples, at least in the ones that I know, of gods who have crazy wild sex lives, who, you know, might cross-dress or who might manifest in the, quote, opposite gender for varying purposes in, you know, their work as gods. So, I mean, you've got, like, examples, and, you know, it's not popular, but in like, Norse mythology, you've got the fact that Loki became a woman for, you know, one purpose, and you've got Thor who dressed as a woman, you know, for another, and so on and so forth. I mean, the idea of gender in mythology has never been, you know, fixated on that binary. You know, you've got the Greek gods who are just putting their dicks in any hole they can find. Pan's brilliantly known for that.
I mean, well, when you have a god that, you know, is the phallic symbol of the world, essentially, which is what Pan usually winds up being, and then you've got, you know, Aphrodite or Venus, who is, you know, just, according to the mythologies that I've read, you know, just seducing men left, right, and center. You know, and that's just two deities out of one pantheon in one little remote region of the world. You know, you can't really say that the gods are on a strict binary anymore.
Nor that they have any sort of repressive sexual morals that they live by. I mean,
oh my God. Just reading the Zeus mythology, you know, there was a Venn diagram at one point where it had a breakdown of all the stories in Greek mythology. And it had this tiny sliver of Aphrodite did something, this tiny sliver of the god of the humans screwed something up. You had this tiny sliver of the humans insulted somebody. And then the entire rest of the thing was Zeus couldn't keep in his pants. That's pretty much
true.
What it is.
And I mean, you get into, especially in Greek mythology, but I'm sure it's elsewhere, you get the idea of even the idea that sex has to be restricted to your own species kind of thing. I mean, in modern culture, it's seen as a very twisted thing to have sex with animals, and yet you've got the Greeks who proudly tell stories about Zeus, for one, who is all over the place. You know, he's up in the air, he's on the ground, he's just like, he's birds, he's cows, he's just all kinds of beasts, and he puts it where he can fit it.
He becomes a weather system at one point.
This is true. I mean,
you know, you've got a girl that's trapped in a cave, been bricked up, it has absolutely no way of having any access with anybody, so he becomes a golden shower. I heard this and I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And then I realized what a golden shower is. For those of you not in the know, this is a sexual act where one person pees on the other.
Which is itself, I mean, as a kid you hear about that golden shower and you don't relate it to that sexual act. But yeah, I mean, it is a really weird, loose, sexual sort of expression. I mean, Greeks are, I mean, they're known for their variations on sexuality. And, I mean, I can't imagine there's any other European pantheon that's got quite the liberal viewpoint on sex, you
well,
know, species-wise, etc.
Loki, who, you know, turned There was Loki who was helping, who came up with the great idea of rebuilding the wall around Asgard. Giant shows up, says, well, I'll do it. They say, okay, well, you got to do it in 1 month. He says, okay, but I need the help of my horse. And so when it was almost done and they were going to have to pay up, the gods, you know, grab Loki and go, this is your damn fault, fix it. And so what does Loki do? He becomes a mayor. He not only crosses gender lines, but he crosses species lines too. And he gave birth to Sepulnir, you know, which is...
That's true, actually.
He had to stay a mayor the entire time. So, yeah, you know.
I mean, it's funny that when you look at mythology, all these different pantheons are considered, like, you know, dismissible. I mean, they're freakishly, like, sexual. They're so liberal about gender and species and all this other stuff. And then you get, like,
The Norse were one of the most male-oriented groups, if you want to look at it, you know, from what the stories that have come down. They weren't really, but they had very definite gender roles. Women stayed home, took care of the farm while the men were out raiding, and the men came back with all the booty, and they, you know, worked on the farm with the ladies, and then they went out raiding again, and it was the guys. You know, they had female warriors, you know, just, and if you want to see it repeated in the gods, look at the Valkyrie. I mean, there you have an entire group that's nothing but female warriors who are running around choosing who's going to die. Why are they doing this? So that they have warriors, and so that Odin has warriors, so that when the end of days come along, they actually have people to fight it. You know,
yeah, and I mean, the Valkyries are going around. They're called the Choosers of the Slain. They're basically choosing, like, Odin's army. They're like stacking the deck for the end of the world.
Because one of the agreement with the Valkyries was that for every warrior that Odin had, Freya, I believe, would get one as well from the same pool of dead. So they had their own, you know, core of people. You know, and yeah, there's the Celts had very definite gender roles. But once again, if you were a girl and you decided that you wanted to be a warrior, the warriors opened their arms to you and accepted you in. There might have been some protests. Dad might have been going, no, you're supposed to marry so-and-so, the baker's son, and have lots of kids, and, oh, screw it, you're going off.
Well,
and
at the same time, I mean, you look at, like, an example like Boudica, for instance. I mean, she's very much a woman. You know, she does the woman thing in her culture, and yet she's, like, this badass, like, warrior woman who goes around and she slaughters a bunch of people. She's like this brilliant war tactician. You know, it's weird that we've inherited this kind of repressive gender binary as far as sex and, you know, gender roles and that sort of thing from Middle Eastern religions that are, I mean, if you believe the origins are what certain scholars have speculated. I mean, the fact that this weird biblical literalism has existed only within, like, the past century and not even that long. I mean, it's been like 50 years at the best. Early days of Christianity and, you know, probably in Judaism, you've got, like, a situation where there was more sexual freedom because it was important to spiritual development. I mean, if you can believe the histories that the various Gnostic expressions that exist today talk about, you know, there wasn't that weird sexual repressive behavior. I mean, yes, women were seen as property. in parts of the world, but that isn't to say that that was the case for the entire, like, known world at the time.
Understand something. There's two myths that go with gender roles. One is that the ancient peoples were gender blind in most cases, and that's just not so. The other is that the ancient peoples had absolute rigid caste systems, and, you know, if you didn't fit into it, then you were forced to fit into it. And that's another one of those myths. And where it touches on gender, there was a lot of gender equality, but there were also groups that were as restrictive as you ever want to get. There were cases where women were traded at, like, trading cards amongst tribes on some of these people, in some Celtic groups that I'm thinking of. And they were absolutely subject to the rulership of their men. And there were also tribes where it was a matrilineal progression, meaning that inheritance came down through the female line rather than the male line. And then there's, you know, some of the groups were absolute matriarchies, where the women ruled everything. The Amazons, for an example. So you can't get the same brushes that we have now where, you know, okay, this group was all this. You can't paint every group in the past with those same brushes because they just don't tend to hold up when you start studying different cultures. Some of them do. There's times when it does, but it's one of those cases of, you know, no true Scotsman, like we talked about two episodes ago, where, you know, no true Scotsman would do this. Well, you know, for every person that you say wouldn't do that, you can find people that absolutely would who are true Scotsmen, you know, who would.
You know, that's so very true.
It's like... you know, one of the things that we were talking about in the break is the Japanese. Here you have a society that has an extremely vested interest from the 1700s, 1800s in a male-female dichotomy. Women going over on and becoming samurai warriors and running around with swords was just not done. However, in that same society, a guy who's gay and puts on a dress and goes out with other gay guys who are also in dresses is like, okay, and it's big deal.
You have to realize, too, that Japan in that era was, I mean, it had its surface appearance. Like, it had the gender binary, you know, the traditional, like, macho samurai warrior, et cetera. The very traditional little woman who's in her kimonos and makeup and so on. But then you got to look at, like, no and kabuki. And, you know, a lot of the gender role, like, a lot of the women's roles in performances were played by men who were physically petite and, you know, effeminate and so on. And you've got, like, warriors, like samurai, who are taking male prostitutes or, you know,
openly
youth
gay
as lovers, etc. And I mean, it's like people who think they're recreating Japan, you know, of the Middle Ages, they have this weird sort of idea that it's a very strict gender binary kind of situation. Men are men and, you know, mighty warrior does this, you know, and then, like, the petite woman walks around with her kimono and her fans, and it's like, no, that's not how it was at all. I mean, you can look at examples in art, in theater, in music. I mean, some of the samurai's important and required training was what we would consider very effeminate arts, like flower arranging and poetry and calligraphy and music and all this stuff. This is all part of being a full and complete samurai warrior. And then you've got like the ninja folks, who these are like rural dwelling families who were fighting against their oppressive warlords by hiring themselves out to the enemies of these same warlords. And they didn't recognize a problem with men being fighters or women being fighters. They simply had different training systems for them. And yet some of the women who were called kunoichi were deadly and skilled assassins. I mean, they would use their feminine wiles. They would use all the very, you know, stereotypical feminine, like, makeup and, you know, sexuality and all this stuff. But they would basically use it to, like, assassinate people and fight fiercely in battle.
Yeah, and just as a point, something that I found very intriguing is most of the ninja, as they're portrayed, were not how they acted. They didn't run around in the black clothes all the time. In fact, you probably would never, you could pass a ninja in the street and never know that they were there, because most of the time they were acting as intelligence gatherers and getting information on people and selling it to people. The assassination was simply a sideline because they happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the whole costume that people have associated with ninja, that full black getup, is it actually comes out of puppetry. Because on stage, was it kabuki? They would wear these black costumes so they would blend into the background so they could act, you know, with like puppets and things on stage, so it would seem like they were invisible. So the idea that they could be invisible came from these black costumes. In reality, on the other hand, it would be strange for someone to encounter a guard or something and be dressed in a full black costume, because they would be like, hey, what's the deal here? Like, why are you dressed all funny? That'd be like us going, you know, to, I don't know, like some rich person's house, say, dressed in like all black, you know, like battle dress uniform with a balaclava and all this kind of thing. People would be like, wait a minute, something's not right here. And you would be forced to fight just to protect your, you know, secret
identity. And you'd have to kill somebody. I mean, it's more logical that you're going to stumble into a gardener that happens to be out walking late at night than stumbling into somebody that's dressed all in black trying to scale up a wall, you know.
Exactly.
With the gardener, you can say, hey, you know, I was just out walking around, and you don't have to kill anybody. If you find somebody that's in black scaling up a wall, they're going to have to fight and kill someone.
Exactly.
Oh, and the puppetry is called Bunraku. It's a black background, and the person that is doing the puppeteering is in all black, and they have very articulate, almost marionettes, that they are manipulating on the stage to do everything. And it's very beautiful if you've never seen it.
I bet it would be really awesome to see. I mean, you get the same kind of effect when you see certain performances. There's like a group that...
There was an episode of The Muppet Show that had something similar. I think Fred Astaire was on the show trying to teach Kermit how to tap dance. Yeah. And he had been sitting on the edge of the stage in the wings watching, and they finally got him out on stage and had him performing part of Singing in the Rain. It's not Fred Astaire? Okay, Gene Kelly. And he was teaching Kermit while on stage how to tap dance. Well, if you look at it very, very closely, what they have is they have a box that Jim Henson is standing in wearing all black with his eyes blacked out, and he's manipulating Kermit in front of him instead of standing underneath the stage like normal for the puppeteering parts. But in order to get Kermit dancing right next to Gene Kelly, who's also dancing, and still be, everybody be safe, they had to have Henson standing on the stage, and they did that with the black background and him in black. And it was
nice.
Cool.
Actually,
yeah.
There's a group that...
Now Mary's playing it.
Of course. Why not? There's a...
Why not?
A group in... That, I mean, I've seen on YouTube, there's a group of, like, mentally challenged or something like that, young people that do that kind of puppetry dressed all in black suits, and they're, you know, on stage acting these puppets out. And it's really cool because it's like blacklight theater.
I've seen those.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And this relates back to Tarot how?
Everything relates to Tarot somehow. I just don't know offhand. But, yeah. Folks, if you've not heard that before, when we were doing Tarot Talk, we would do these back and forth discussions about random topics, you know, toward the end of the show. And when we strayed into realms unknown, we would always try and say, this relates to Tarot in this way, just to sort of keep it to the theme kind of thing. But we realized that ultimately those discussions, like this one, are part of the fun of having the show, right? Like, people enjoyed those back and forth discussions, and it was those that people would participate in. I kind of want to invite you, right? Oh, of course. I mean, it's a hilarious thing, because we always end up going off on tangents that are like, wow, where did that come from?
But it would always relate back to what we were talking about eventually.
It really would, yeah.
We got off onto ninja and puppetry, but when you think about it, you know, if there's no gender roles in some of the greatest groups that have ever been known, the ninja, then why the hell do we have such defined gender roles in society now? You know?
And their progeny is set, and they need to get a grip and get over it.
So there you go. That was Mary, by the way. Oh, God.
Now, folks, I want to just bring up our number so that if you guys want to participate in the discussion right now, you can feel free to. The number is 646-564-9966. Obviously, if you're listening to this recording after the show's live, you're not going to be able to participate. So if you want to do that, call in now. If you want to participate in the chat right on the website right now with the broadcast tonight, we have a chat room on Blog Talk Radio that you can sign up for an account on BTR and jump into the conversation with questions or ideas, etc. Because part of our enjoyment... Go ahead.
Okay. Part of our enjoyment is actually getting feedback from you guys and hearing, you know, that we did a good job or we, you know, screwed up, because then that helps us make a podcast that you want to listen to. So we do need you guys to talk to us and call us, send us emails. You can do that through Magical Musings. I'm Joy at Magical Musings. He's Brian at MagicalMusings.net. And we'll get those. We can plan for additional shows off of those. We can relate to the shows that we just had or ones that are coming up. So, yeah, we need audience participation here.
And one of the things that we're planning on doing with our website, MagicalMusings.net, is to post various and sundry articles that relate to random thoughts that we have. Each of us has a blog that we do the same thing on. But with Magical Musings, what we're planning on kind of doing is gauging the reactions of the people who visit. You know, if you read a particular article that we've posted, we might have a show coming up. You know, we might schedule a show based on that because it got so much feedback or it was so popular. Speaking of blogs, actually, if you want to hit us up on Tumblr, there are three blogs related to us two and the show itself, or at least to Woodwose Radio. The first being Woodwose Radio. It's Woodwose, Woodwose, hyphen radio. .tumblr.com. My own blog is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. And Joy's is wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. We love getting messages from you guys. We love having you guys follow us. You know, you want to talk shit about the show? We are all ears. We want to know what's good, what's bad. You know, if you're offended by our swearing, you might have to get over it because we do talk like this normally. It's not something that we're going to change. If you want to talk about...
And if you are offended and, you know, you don't want the kids listening to this, then my suggestion is, you know, either teach them that this is the way people talk or don't let them listen because, I mean, this is advanced stuff. This is the Wicca and Paganism 301 classes that everybody is supposed to be talking about and that the books are supposed to be dealing with, but that don't. So, you know, you may want to just make sure that the kids can keep with the basic stuff and then slowly start introducing them into the more advanced concepts like this. We do have two more topics in the half hour that we have left. That relate to the show tonight. First off, Mary has shown me a section in Wikipedia on Z Budapest's page talking about her transphobia. So it is documented. There are multiple witnesses. There are lots of people on the Dianic University online page. And she is quoted as saying, "This is a woman-only space for females born female. If you truly love the goddess, then respect her Dianic tradition." And that's a direct quote from Z Budapest. So what? Interestingly, the same website makes use of the pentacle on a number of pages. Pentacle in Wicca symbolizes the triple goddess with the horned god or in ceremonial magic as the union between male and female, which is what the pentagram represents in the ceremonial. So that's like, wow. hypocrite much? Anyway, the two remaining topics, one is etiquette and one is the questionable topic of kink and sexuality with paganism, okay? The etiquette should be, I mean, a no-brainer. No touchy, no feely, without permission or consent, and even then, enthusiastic participation and consent is the only consent that you need, or that you should be accepting.
Looking for,
consent.
Yeah.
Right, because, I mean... Like in normal life, if somebody is too drunk to a coherent sentence together in the circle, they can't really consent to having sex with you. And that's, you know, not something that's not a line you really want to cross, because rape in the circle, rape at pagan gatherings, rape at a event is still rape. I mean, that's should be an absolute no-brainer. And it's amazing how many people think that simply because paganism and because Wicca has a more liberal moral code that they can come up and grab somebody's tit for no particular reason. And I'm sorry, that's a basic violation of personal space. You know, there should be absolutely no question that you see somebody, you think you might want to get together with them, talk to them about it. Make sure that, you know, they're consenting with it. And if they have a partner, make sure that their partner is fine with it. Because anything else, and that's, you know, a basic betrayal of what you're trying to get, which is, you know, the love and the celebration. And, you know, that's a violation of the basic Wiccan code of harm none. You know, do what you will. If it harms no one, do what you want. Well, having sex with somebody, even if they're, you know, enthusiastically consenting to it, if they have a spouse who is not enthusiastically consenting with it, that's a harm, not only to the spouse, but to the person that you're having the sex with. So, you know, this is something that you got to just decide, okay, this is how it's going to be, and work from there.
Exactly.
And it should be a no-brainer. You would be amazed at how many times it's not.
Yes, drunkenness does not... It's not an automatic consent. I mean, let's be mature. Let's not assume that drunkenness or stonedness are consents. You know, just because you're into someone doesn't mean they're into you.
And when Mike Nichols has to write a whole article on not having sex with everybody at a pagan gathering, and that these pagan gatherings aren't orgies that are organized for your benefit, you know, it's, you got to question about something being wrong at that point. And so it's time to start changing the mindset. So that's it on etiquette. You know, it's don't, pretty much. The other topic, like I said, is kink and sexuality. Now, we kind of touched on this 2 weeks ago with the it's not my kink thing, and this kind of is along the same lines. There is a subset in paganism that is very much into the pagan belief system, the Lord and Lady, the specific deities, you know, whatever classification of non-Christian, non-Hindu, non-Buddhist, non-Jewish, non-Islam you want to grab, that are also into bondage, domination, and sadomasochism. And this is one of those things where I can talk with authority because I'm part of that subset. And it's not necessarily a total separation. I mean, if we're going to talk about, frankly, about sex in paganism, sex in Wicca, sex in the celebration of the deities, you also have to add in that there are going to be those who find comfort in releasing not only their hang-ups and their daily mindset of I have to be in control of everything to someone else, but that there are people that are going to enjoy not being able to move very much and restraint and in some cases physical pain. Okay. I'm not going to get into the whole BDSM mindset. There's tons of literature out there if you're interested in reading it. 50 Shades of Grey is not a credible site or book for understanding this. Neither is The Story of O. There are lots of other credible ones, however. But
there's one
it comes
called,
down to...
Sorry, there's two that I can think of off the top of my own head. One's called Sacred Kink, and I want to say it's Lee Callender who wrote that one. I might be wrong. Check it out on Amazon. I can't swear to it. The other is Donald Krieg's Sex Magic that sort of alludes to it, I think. It's been a while since I looked at that one. But, yeah, I mean, the books are out there. You know, don't be afraid to look them up if you're interested.
One more resource is Kink Magic by Lupa and Taylor Elwood, which I have an article in there for them. But basically what it comes down to is it is theorized by some that Gardner was a kinky ass. There's a lot of elements in the beginning of Wicca that have extreme kink and BDSM and sadomasochistic elements to it. One of them is the Witch's Cradle, which we did talk about, which is essentially sensory deprivation with a straitjacket. Another one is the flagellation that they have as part of the rituals, where you are literally whipping another person. And the symbolism there is that you always have to pay for your knowledge, and therefore whatever is done to another person comes back at you threefold, and this is a way to bring that to the fore. However, as an isolated entity, those, yes, are extremely kinky. However, in a sacred setting, they can become extremely meditative. I mean, they have, I mean, if you just look at Catholicism, they have a subset of the Catholic liturgy and dogma where you're mortifying your own flesh. You're whipping yourself with a scourge as a submission to God and a way to meditate, and because Christ was scourged, okay?
And, I mean, you saw allusions to it in, what was that one? Shoot. The Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code. Mm-hmm. Although, to give them credit, the excoriation in there was much more extreme than the people that adhere to it in the Catholic Church do.
That's true.
He was extreme on it. And, yeah, you have this barbed thing that you wear around your thigh all the time as a reminder, but it's supposed to be used, you know, very limitedly, and it's not supposed to draw blood. It's supposed to only bring slight discomfort as a reminder, not be something that, you know, you have bloody trails rolling down your legs with.
Yes. So in that element, it was obviously exaggerated in the Da Vinci Code, but the idea of causing pain for yourself is common to multiple spiritual paths as a way to focus your mind and to obviously offer. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, offer, yeah, the suffering to the deities if they're into that. In BDSM itself, the pain and the release. I mean, okay, just from a physiological standpoint, you hit yourself. Your brain is going to immediately release chemicals in the brain to suppress the pain associated with that act. Okay, they're called endorphins. They're responsible for everything from runner's high to hallucinations during fevers, okay? The act of hitting yourself is going to release those. Well, in sadomasochism and in a lot of worship, you have someone else hit you with the scourge or the whip or, you know, whatever it is that you're using to as a way to release those endorphins so that you get high. You can purge those feelings from you. You can offer up the suffering to the deities. You can purify yourself. But the reason that you have someone else do it is because when you're in that mental state, you are in an altered state of consciousness, a massive altered state of consciousness, and you can't always judge how you're doing or when to stop.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, if you've got a whip in your hand and you're hitting yourself and you're getting high off doing that, that's great. But the bodily impulse is to keep doing it because it feels good after a little while because of the endorphins. Well, if you flayed your back, you're not necessarily going to know that. So you have someone else
definitely.
Doing it. So
I mean, ultimately, it's like having someone else drum for you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It's a participation thing. The restraint comes in that it is possible. Well, the symbolism for the restraint in sexuality and in Wicca and paganism is that you're restrained in the womb. You are confined. You can't move. There is something inhibiting you from stretching out. It's dark, it's comfortable, it's warm, and going through the birth canal allows you to move into the wider world. Well, it's a rite of passage in that you're being born. It's a way to bring back that feeling of constraint and being safe and in the womb. You see it with some sweat lodges. Where you have a very small area where it's very warm, where you can hear a drum beat going on outside, and then all of a sudden they, you know, pull the lodge off, and there you are exposed to the elements, and you're not warm anymore. You're cold. It's a way to recreate the birth experience and a rite of passage from one state into another. That's why a lot of those elements have gotten pulled into not only Wicca, but into other pieces of paganism. Two other things. There's a subculture called the furry subculture, wherein the person who is participating in it takes on the aspect of an animal. Okay. In a lot of cases, it's animals that they identify very strongly with, but they act in such a manner. In the BDSM subculture, these are pony play, puppy and kitty play, where the person that is doing this is acting like a cat or like a dog. And they're on the floor, they're naked, they're running around. This is a little bit more prevalent in paganism, because at some celebrations you will see people who do a thing called skin shifting, where they will dance and they will take on, and their totem will possess them, and they will become that animal for a little while. It's a means of transformation. It's a way to identify with your spirit animal a lot stronger, to celebrate them. And yes, it does touch on sexuality some, because there's times, and, you know, I haven't ever experienced this myself, but I understand that there are times when it is possible that the animal spirit who is currently possessing you will demand to have sex with somebody. And yeah, I'm horny. Let's fuck. Let's get the puppies. Let's get the kittens. Let's get the eggs laid. And it's another, you know, way of bringing the fertility back. If this is happening and it makes you uncomfortable, go someplace else, because this is another part of celebrating. This is another part of becoming that person for a little while. And letting them have, I guess it would be more than a little taste of life here.
Well, and I think, too, that, I was just thinking about how this kind of translates to the practice of voodoo as well, because you've got that spirit taking over, and you've got cases where the spirit will demand that you undergo, like, either torture or sexual practices or various other things that in your own normal state of consciousness you would never, ever undergo. And yet, you know, mm-hmm. you've got, perhaps you may be ridden by Urzuli, who is like the goddess of love, and she may want you to engage in sexual relations with someone else in the circle. I don't personally know because I'm not a practitioner of voodoo. If you happen to be and you're listening, by all means, please correct me if I'm wrong. But basically, I mean, the whole idea of being possessed by any sort of spirit is a very shamanic element, and it can really enhance your particular practice, whatever path you may be on.
Yeah, and if I understand correctly from some that have undergone this stuff, it's usually limited to kissing and fondling. It doesn't necessarily get into actual sexual, procreative, penetrative, sexual acts. So, you know, a goddess of love who has possessed you, taken over, and comes over and grabs some random person and starts kissing, snogging the crap out of them, you know, they're probably it's probably just going to be kissing and, okay, I'm going to grab your genitals and make you really excited and give you a massive case of blue balls, and then I'm going to leave, type of thing. But you always have to watch out for the sexual predator who's using that as an excuse to grab you. You know,
that's very
anybody
true.
That has been or anybody that's been around possession, shamanic transformation, skin dancing, things like that, can tell when it's a true manifestation and when it's somebody faking it, because the aura shifts around the person. Watch out for that, because there are times that people are going to try to use what's going on in the circle, in the dance, whatever, as a way to cop a feel.
But to be fair, I mean, that,
again,
that can happen in... Sorry. I mean, that can happen
no, go ahead.
Anywhere. You've got, like, tantra classes where, I mean, the instructor may just be a sex addict or something like that, and he may just be using, you know, direct contact or personal involvement in sexual activity as a way to get his own freak on, and, you know, and he may just be using the guise of helping you in order to get, you know, what he wants. It happens in any spiritual tradition, so don't just think that pagans themselves are dealing with that situation. You're dealing with it anywhere.
Mm. Yeah, but it's always good to, you know, remind people that there are predators out there. There are people that are trying to take advantage of people. A lot of the predators, in my experience, a lot of those that are in it just for themselves get found out and drummed out kind of quickly in paganism in general, because they wind up exposing themselves, and I'm not talking about dropping their clothes and stuff. they do something and it makes someone feel uncomfortable, and a lot of times in the good groups, they get rid of that person pretty quickly. The problem comes in that it's not reported to anybody. So you have this guy who is a pervert who wants to see your kids naked, who is in the circle, who makes an advance at one of them. They feel uncomfortable. They tell mom and dad. Mom and dad talk to the high priest and priestess. They throw this guy out of the circle. He finds another coven to join and repeats the same thing, because the high priest and priestess want to keep it, you know, quiet and not embarrass themselves, and so they don't tell anybody. So, you know, you got to not only take care of your own people, but you need to also make sure that you're getting in touch with the proper authorities and letting them know what's going on. Despite the fact that, you know, you're a secret organization, you don't have to go in and say, oh, I'm part of the Order of the Quiet rose, and we're going to, we had a ceremony, and he did this and did that to the kids. No, you don't have to do that. But you need to go to the police and say, okay, he made inappropriate advances to these children, you know, and get him labeled as a sexual predator so that when he tries it again, he's caught.
Exactly. So, I mean,
so that's it for me.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, when you're dealing with sex in ritual, take all the precautions you would if you were in a club or anywhere else. We've got like 2 minutes left of the show, so I want to thank everyone for listening in. Don't be afraid to drop us emails at brian or joy@magicalmusings.net. That's magic without the K, one word. Our website is magicalmusings.net, and you heard our various blogs. You can hit us up on Tumblr. Feel free to call in the show when we're going live. Join us in the chat room. Otherwise, have a great night.
There's ads,
folks,
on our website. Don't be afraid to click on them.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah.
Oh,
if
yeah.
You... There's that, too. But, yeah, I mean, we want to hear from you folks. We want to know what we're doing well, what we suck at. Because otherwise we can't change, you know. You don't know the problems exist, you won't change those. So let us know what you like, what you don't like, and have a great night otherwise.
Take care, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye, folks.